academic director of the Center for Hindu Studies here at Oxford. I'd like to welcome you all, particularly members of the Oxford general community and the people in the neighborhood who are here for the first time. I'd like to thank you for coming tonight. The Oxford Center for Hindu Studies undertakes many activities, obviously most of them directly connected with the study of topics in the Hindu tradition. But we also like to engage all kinds of contemporary issues, issues that are of relevance in the wider modern world, obviously in religion, in ethics, in philosophy, but also more broadly in the sciences, in the humanities in various ways, and therefore bring into conversation with those contemporary topics perspectives from the Hindu traditions of India. And tonight I think we have a splendid example of this project where we're dealing with issues about our own future, about the nature of life in this world and how we think about it scientifically and humanly, and then looking for some wisdom both from within the West and from the Indian context. Our speaker tonight, Professor Brian Goodwin, who we're very happy to have with us, is a distinguished scholar who brings many strengths and areas of expertise to our conversation. Born in Canada, that's one area of expertise, I suppose. Studied biology at McGill University, came here to Oxford to study mathematics, apparently finished studying at Oxford 50 years ago, and is amazingly young and vital for having achieved that 50 years ago, and received a PhD from Edinburgh University in 1960. After research appointments at McGill and MIT in Massachusetts, became reader in biology at the University of Sussex, where he was for some 18 years, and then professor of biology at the Open University. He is now a visiting scholar at Shoemaker College and teaches in the MSc in Holistic Science. He's also been associated with the Santa Fe Institute since its very beginning. He's published widely, over 100 articles in refereed journals, dealing with a range of topics, including developmental biology, evolution, the dynamics of social insects, human health, and dynamic principles of human organizations. He has numerous, a number of books as well. One from 1996, Form and Transformation, Generative and Relational Principles in Biology. Another one, 2000, from Basic Books, Signs of Life, How Complexity Pervades Biology. He's currently preparing a book, which will be out shortly, we hope, The Honey Guide, The Evolution of Qualities. And sort of lurking behind tonight's presentation, I think, is another book with a fine title, How the Leopard Changed Its Spots, which is evidently a reference to Kipling, The Evolution of Complexity. And this book has been well received and came out first in 1994, but has reprinted in the Princeton Science Library very recently, and received reviews such as this: Goodwin's book genuinely illuminates the mysteries of biological development. This is a brilliant book, wonderfully written. Goodwin is a real scholar of great breadth. He writes beautifully, conveying difficult themes in an exciting manner. So we have a very speaker we're very honored to have in our midst tonight, who has taken up a very complicated topic, cultural myths, it sounds to me at least, not being a scientist, cultural myths, biological forms, and subjective qualities, Western and Hindu views of the philosophy of biology. Our format will be that Professor Goodwin will speak 45, 50 minutes or so. You can watch the clock if you need to. And then the genius behind this entire program is Jonathan Edelman, one of our students here in the university in the Science and Religion program, and the convener of a number of sessions that the center has already had in Science and Religion. He will bring to bear on Professor Goodwin's presentation questions and issues from the Hindu perspective, to open it up on that side of the angle, because I think you don't claim to be an expert on Hinduism.
No way.
And then we'll open it up for general discussion and finish at 6:30, quarter to 7, something like that. So thank you all for coming, and welcome, Professor Goodwin.
Thank you very much, Frank. Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be here. This is of course, a first for me. When I showed this title to my wife yesterday, she said, you know something about biological forms. I don't really know much about myths. you may know a bit about subjective qualities, but you certainly don't know anything about Hindu views and philosophy of biology. So she had it right. And therefore, Jonathan is going to do the commentary with respect to Hindu philosophy. I'm going to concentrate on the areas that I do understand something about. Mythos is a kind of encompassing theme because this is the area of human expression that gives meaning to worldviews. So it's, that's the way I'm looking at it. Mythos is the domain of meaning, meaning significance. And of course, in modernity, that is to say, in modern science, we have a mythos which is effectively embodied in the industrial age, and it's the mythos of the mechanical philosophy. That is the distinctive contribution of Western science to the acquisition of reliable knowledge about nature. And it is an extremely effective way of getting, as I say, reliable knowledge. Reliable, what I mean is intersubjective, that is, a methodology that's intersubjective. And I'm going to say more about this, because this, I think, is one of the great contributions of Western science, is a kind of democratic, consensual way of gaining knowledge. But, of course, it has severe limitations, and the limitations are becoming more and more apparent, and these are the ones that I want to explore and suggest that, along with people like Thomas Berry, that... Well, that's quite an interesting conversation going on.
It's a constant disturbance.
Yeah, it's quite very lively, isn't it? More lively than the conversation we have.
No,
no.
Very interesting whatsoever.
Anyway, there we are. Contemporary mythos breaking through. So, what I want to do then is to explore the possibility of a shift in worldview that, as I mentioned, Thomas Berry has written about in the great work. And this is something that is, it's very deep, and it is very important. And those of you who have read The Independent in the last couple of days will have seen that Jim Lovelock has come out with a very, Sir James Lovelock, sorry, I know him as Jim, because he comes to the college, Schumacher College, to teach, and so he's a colleague. But James Lovelock, the author of the Gaia Hypothesis, has pointed out that global warming is the major danger on Earth today, and therefore this is the thing that, in a sense, we need to engage with. And it's the whole transformation of a way of thinking, doing, acting, being, that Thomas Berry talks about in The Great Work. The Great Work, of course, is the English version of Magnum Opus, which used to be the alchemical transformation, so it involves personal transformation as well as praxis, engagement in the world. And so this is where the connection between Western and Hindu views will actually come in, because the transformation that we seem to be on the edge of, or possibly on the edge of, is something that links us very much more closely to, I think, traditional ways of knowing, which emphasize qualities all the time. I was talking to Jonathan about this after lunch. And so there are divergences and convergences that, that Jonathan is going to explore afterwards. But usually I would go around and find out who is what in this room, but I think I'm going to forego that pleasure and hope that I might find out as the discussion proceeds. It's nice to have some sort of personal contact, but I'm just going to proceed, if you'll excuse me for being somewhat academic in this mode. I'm going to start with... what has happened to biology in relation to this mechanical worldview. And of course, it's terribly easy to produce a caricature of aspects of modern biology. And it's not my intention to produce a straw man that I can then knock down. I really want to point to certain aspects of modern biology that really have failed rather dramatically and are failing us in our relationship with the natural world and with each other. So if I just say that essentially a mechanical philosophy, it is a mythos and therefore gives meaning to the search for knowledge, but the only quality it has is truth. In other words, the idea of modernity is we seek the truth about reality. But in order to do so, the methodology is, of course, to withdraw all subjective qualitative evaluations and to use a methodology of the quantitative sciences, which were obviously introduced by the Greek atomists. I mean, this notion that there's nothing but atoms in the void, a quantitative view of the world, it has been with us for a long time. But it was Galileo who introduced a very effective local methodology. By local, I mean a very modest exploration of the aspects of reality that are important for understanding what we regard as objective, the objective aspects of the real world. Now, I'm going to come back to objectivity because it comes out of a certain methodology. And so I'm going to return to that when I talk about a science of qualities. Now, what we have in modernity is a science of quantities and the mathematization. It's the mathematics that gives order to quantities. And it was John Locke who defined these quantities as primary qualities of nature. Primary qualities of nature. And qualities, that is, beauty and joy and the all the qualities that we live our lives in terms of, that is, well-being, health. There are quantitative aspects of these. There are quantitative aspects of health, but well-being is a quality that we experience. And so these were relegated to the category of secondary qualities by John Locke, and they have been put into the basket called subjectivity in modernity. And therefore, they are the realm of the idiosyncratic, the personal, the unreliable aspects of knowledge, or the qualitative aspects of nature. So when we evaluate each other, which we do all the time, and we're doing right at this moment, in terms of truth, honesty, reliability, and so on and so forth. These are all qualities. And these are regarded as secondary, unreliable judgments, right? Subject to great uncertainty, whereas the quantitative aspects, you know, how much does the book weigh, we have a methodology. We have a very good methodology for it, reaching consensus on how much this book weighs. And then we use that knowledge to control aspects of the natural world, which we do through technology. So science and technology in modernity is dedicated to using reliable knowledge for particular purposes. And this has been a fantastically successful adventure. But obviously now it has reached its limitations. And so a world of quantities is a world in which we try to substitute quality of life by quantities of consumer goods or salary or whatever it may be. And this is well known to all of us. So I don't want to belabor that point. What I would like to do is just observe that this mechanical worldview, when applied to organisms, which includes us, of course, means that our knowledge of the world through this science of quantities and mathematization, there is no place for ethics or responsibility or, as I said, beauty, joy, love in such a world. They are not regarded as objectively real. And so ethics and responsibility are kind of add-on. They're something that come from the human way of being in the world. And, of course, the naturalistic fallacy says that it is very important not to confuse what is with what ought to be. These are sharply distinguished, and this is the positivist view of knowledge, that it is it's objective, it's independent of humans. Reality exists independently, we can know it independently, and it does not depend upon ethical evaluation or a sense of responsibility. Now, it's not my job, I don't want to knock that view, because I think it is extremely valuable, and it's given us the tools, actually, to achieve some kind of ecological transformation in terms of reducing our footprint on the Earth, because our footprint is just, you know, if we're going to go on living as a human race, we need 3, 4, 5 planets Earth to support our needs. And we haven't got them. So it's a pretty serious situation, and the result of our actions are now very clear. And the most dramatic one is global warming. So the result of this, what's the result of this view been in biology itself with respect to our view of organisms? Because what I want to do is rethink. Biology is my subject. I did biology first, then mathematics, and I've done a combination of these two throughout my professional career. But of course at Schumacher, what we do is holistic science, which is an attempt to go transdisciplinary and to engage with all the disciplines, but to do so in a fairly rigorous way, in ways that are addressed to the issues that we face. So it's a matter of a conceptual framework which allows us to engage in forms of praxis which are relevant to now, the current issues. So that's our idea. And Schumacher, of course, with Small is Beautiful, was the inspiration. Schumacher, the economist who was in the Labour government years ago in the 60s and 70s. And it's his vision that, in a sense, we want to implement at Schumacher College. So this is knowledge for practical transformation of the individual and the communal and the social. All right, biology. What happens to biology from a mechanical worldview? Well, as you know, the conception of biology, modern biology, is very much in the image of Darwin. And Darwin combined with genetic insights of the 19th and particularly 20th century, and therefore organisms have been regarded as the results of the actions of their genomes, and the genes have been selected by natural selection by virtue of the properties that they confer on organisms in their ability to survive in a particular habitat. Now, I think this is familiar to everybody because it's part of the culture. Am I right?
Yes,
the selfish gene is, I think, one of the clearest, because not only does it make the point clearly, but it also does it in metaphorical terms,
yes,
which are very interesting.
Yes.
And these are the ones that I want to actually explore, because there's a kind of internal contradiction in the notion of selfish gene. But I mean, Richard Dawkins would say, selfish is a metaphor. And what we mean by that is that it confers selective advantage on the organism.
Yes.
So it's a perfectly good quantitative science way of defining what selfishness means. So that's not an internal contradiction. Sounds like it, but it isn't. So organisms are, that is, the form, and by form I mean the morphology and the behavior of the organism, the actual three-dimensional form, but also the behavior, because that's an aspect, that's form in time. It's a way, you know, the flight of a dove, or the actual behavior of the fish. These are forms. These are actually, they engage in movements which have characteristic shape and form. So that I'm using the term form in both a behavioral and a morphological sense. Morphology being, of course, Goethe's term, he introduced it. And I'm going to come back to Goethe, because in a sense the science of qualities starts with Goethe. I mean, the science of qualities that I'm going to elaborate on later starts with Goethe. So that's the romantic reaction to modernity. But just to remind you of this view of organisms. Sorry. Richard Dawkins' writings have been extremely useful in clarifying the roots and the metaphorical foundation of neo-Darwinism, and the mythological foundation, if you like. And that's what I've explored to some extent in one of the chapters, in How the Leopard Changed Its Spots. And if I could just read this out to you, I had this prepared for overheads, but you don't run to overheads, and I'm perfectly happy with that. I'll read it out. So here's a summary of the neo-Darwinian view of organisms. Organisms are constructed by groups of genes whose goal is to leave more copies of themselves. Remember, this is metaphorical, whose goal. The hereditary material is basically selfish. The inherently selfish qualities of the hereditary material are reflected in the competitive interactions between organisms that result in survival of fitter variants generated by the more successful genes. Organisms are constantly trying to get better, that is, fitter. In a mathematical geometrical metaphor, they're always trying to climb up local peaks in a fitness landscape in order to do better than their competitors. However, the landscape keeps changing. As evolution proceeds, so the struggle is endless. This is the Red Queen story from Alice in Wonderland. Paradoxically, humans can develop altruistic qualities that contradict their inherently selfish nature by means of educational and other cultural efforts. Now, this is Richard Dawkins. This is from the Selfish Gene. And the last bit I found extremely interesting, because you asked the question, how could a machine, and of course, according to the blind watchmaker, we are indeed machines. I can just quote Richard again. Each one of us is a machine, like an airliner, only much more complicated. Were we designed on a drawing board too, and were our parts assembled by a skilled engineer? The answer is no. It is a surprising answer, and we have known and understood it for only a century or so. And he goes on in this vein. So we are complex machines designed by natural selection, and genes that have this metaphorical quality of selfishness. That is, they're selected because of their selective advantage to the organism in a particular habitat. Now, it's somewhat strange that a machine can escape from its actual nature and become altruistic. And that is a genuine contradiction. In that point of view. Now, I'm sure there are ways of elaborating on this that sound like getting out of the contradiction, but what I'm interested in is not so much the logic of this as the mythological or metaphorical origins of this. Where does this view come from? Where does this originate in our culture? Because it's very familiar to us. I mean, this idea that we are in competition with each other, with other species, and of course we're doing terribly well in this. In one sense, we are the dominant species. We are occupying more and more of the globe. We're using more and more of the resources. We're clearly the superior species. But the race we're winning, of course, is the race to destruction. And yet, here we have this idea that we can become altruistic. And I'd like to just suggest that there is a mythological foundation for this in our culture. And if I could just read you 4 points that mirror these 4 points that I read out about organisms, and I think you'll recognize where this comes from. Here they are. Humanity is born in sin. We have a base inheritance. I mean, that's like, you know, this is the hereditary material is basically selfish. Humanity is therefore condemned to a life of conflict and perpetual toil. That's the competition and constantly struggling up these peaks in fitness landscapes, which is the picture, the mathematical picture that's developed for natural selection. The fourth one, paradoxically, humans can develop altruistic qualities that contradict their inherently selfish nature by means of education and other cultural efforts. But by faith and moral effort, humanity can be saved from its fallen, selfish state. Now, these four properties or ways of describing the human condition: humanity is born in sin, we have a base inheritance, condemned to a life of conflict and perpetual toil, but by faith and moral effort, humanity can be saved from its fallen, selfish state, is a particular kind of Christian fundamentalism. And it's a very stark form of Christian fundamentalism. And what I found so illuminating in Richard Dawkins' book was that he makes that very clear. He doesn't say it that way, but it seemed to me that was just suddenly blindingly obvious that this was a Christian fundamentalist reading of the biological realm. And of course, if you go back to Darwin trained as he was going to become a clergyman, so of course he was steeped in this tradition. Sin and redemption was a prominent part of that. And Darwin also did this play of mirrors in looking at market capitalism in the 19th century and saying civilization emerges through competition. I mean, Darwin's very clear, and Desmond Morris and Jim Moore, in their book on Darwin, make this point over and over again, that the dominant belief in the 19th century in Victorian society was that civilization is achieved through competition, that market capitalism is an expression of this, and Darwin took the ideas of market capitalism, put them into biology in terms of natural selection, and they stayed there because this is an absolutely legitimate way of explaining aspects of biological evolution. In other words, I'm not saying that this is wrong. I'm saying it's got significant elements of correctness about it. But nevertheless, by the time we get to the 20th century, what has happened is people are saying, this is the truth in biology, the way Richard Dawkins is saying, this is the truth, this is the way things really are in biology. And therefore, our economy should reflect this biological truth, because that's the pattern of evolution. So you can see there's a kind of play of mirrors here. Darwin looks at the culture that produces civilization, as he claims, and as many, many other contemporaries claim. And he says, well, that must be working in the natural world as well. Competition, that is progress, the notion of progress through competition. Then in the 20th century, people have accepted Darwin. They say, this is the way things really happen. And our economic system should reflect that. So you get a further a justification for the economic system that dominates in contemporary life throughout the whole of the across the globe. And so the question I want to ask is, what is missing from this view of biology? Now, what does it leave out of organisms? And the paper that I sent to Jonathan was called Evolution with Meaning. In other words, what I want to do briefly here, and you'll have to keep an eye on the time for me.
About 15 minutes
more? Okay. Right. So the question is, what does this view leave out, and how can we rethink evolution with meaning? Because the mechanical worldview has the implication that there is no meaning, there's no intrinsic meaning at all to evolution. And organisms themselves cannot be said to be expressing any kind of meaning. So the notion of meaning is absent. Now, in order to rethink evolution from the point of view of meaning, I need to give you a definition of meaning and then use it in relation to organisms. And I'm going to use a definition of meaning that comes from a book by somebody called Peter Kaws. Peter Kaws is he's a philosopher. He wrote a book called Structuralism, The Art of the Intelligible, published in 1988.
Could you tell me how you spell his name?
C-A-W-S.
Thank you.
It's a good name for a philosopher, isn't it? I take the recognition of meaning, I'm quoting from Peter Kaws. I take the recognition of meaning and the cathesis, concentration of psychic energy on a single goal, cathesis, that this involves to be the joint product of two more fundamental processes, which I shall call respectively signifying and mattering. Signifying is the defining property of science and the fundamental mark of the intelligible. Mattering is the defining property of value and the fundamental mark of the purposive. Value and purpose are joined together with intelligibility, distinguishing different things. So this is what meaning is about in terms of Peter Kaws' definition. Now I'll give you another quotation from Kaws that I think gives us a way of thinking about evolution in which meaning is intrinsic to the process. So here's Kaws. The roots of mattering lie in the structure of biological needs, and it is in the intelligent satisfaction of those needs that meaning first comes into play. In the case of the matching of a structure of praxis with a structure of desire, the properties of the purposive to the intelligible is very high. As the immediacy of need lessens, the balance of the two components changes. Until at an advanced stage of culture or education, a very complex structure of intelligibility may be evoked by almost casual purposes. One of the ways in which the meaningfulness of significant activity is maintained is through an intention to pursue the intelligible for its own sake. And in high civilizations, this becomes, in literature, music, art, and other forms of creative activity, the dominant exercise of meaning. Now, that's very dense. That's a very dense statement. But I'm going to sort of go on and paraphrase that, because what I want to do is to say evolution is about, first of all, the intelligent satisfaction of their needs by organisms. Now, nobody would quibble with that except intelligent. The mechanistic view would say, no, it's not intelligent, it's a machine. So you can't say it's intelligent. It didn't have a designer. We cannot call organisms intelligent. And I want to challenge that. I think organisms do satisfy their needs in very intelligent ways.